Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you, Clément. It's always lovely to be introduced by an old friend, and also lovely to be able to give a talk at an event celebrating someone wonderful. So, congratulations, Sib. My filing system on photos is not as good as some of the other speakers here, so I don't have any photos of us, even though I'm sure many have been taken at various points. But it's been a really, really nice interaction over the years. So I'm going to talk today a little bit about some of our work on materials design, particularly thinking about healthcare applications. I just want to give a little shout out first to my group in the top right, and to make the point that not only do they come from all over the world, but also many different backgrounds. And so we have a mixture of engineers, with chemists, physicists, cell biologists, and even surgeons. And this multidisciplinary grouping is what's very important for the sort of work we do at Interfaces. And we are very interested in fundamental science, but also thinking how that can go through to applications. And I'll show a few of the ways this is translated into society during the talk. We moved about a year ago to this new institute at Oxford after 20 years at Imperial College. And this is an institute that I'm helping to lead. And this is really all around this same motivation that helps me in my own research group, which is thinking about how we can bring different disciplines together to tackle very difficult problems. And so the way the Institute is set up is we have people from across Oxford University, from medicine, from physics, from chemistry, and then we have coffee every week on a different floor so that everybody mixes. And you can see the architecture, the design of the building, which is fantastic. On the right there is a very open structure so that you see people as you kind of walk around and have a lot of conversations. And this sort of environment is going to be, I think, really transformative for our science. So we're working at the interface of materials and biology, and we can apply that in different ways. A lot of our work is in tissue repair and advanced therapeutics. However, we've also done a lot of work in detection of diseases using materials technologies. And then you can see underpinning it at the bottom, this kind of slice of the pie that we call characterization. And this is work that we do to really understand material structures and also biological tissue, and involves application of state-of-the-art characterization, but also the invention of some new characterization techniques that we've developed within our own lab and even taken to the market. So one of the big areas we've worked on is regenerative medicine, and this led us to create, about 10 years ago, this UK regenerative medicine program, Smart Materials Hub. And this brought together 11 different universities, and I've been serving as a director. And we developed lots of different materials for regenerative medicine, so hydrogels, printed systems, materials that can interact with the immune system, and other sort of nanostructured materials. But what's different about this hub is that we also set it up so it would have embedded safety and regulatory advice, advice on scale-up and manufacturing, and really translation. And all of the early career researchers from day one on their project are taught to think about the target product profile of the material that they're going to develop. And that's been very, very successful, has led to a lot of spin-outs, as well as three human trials being set up. But one of the questions we kind of always ask ourselves, and this is reflected in these articles you can see there that are just perspective opinion pieces, is how much complexity should we put into the materials design? Because it's really, really important that whatever we design ends up also having a good shot at translating to the patient, as we've heard today in some of the other talks. And so we can think about that theoretically, but we can also do some quite fundamental studies to give us some information on this question. And so, for example, in this science paper, what we do is use electron microscopy to zoom in right down to the nanoscale of bone to better understand that organization between the organic and inorganic components. And so you can use these kind of very advanced microscopies to tell you about biological tissue. And in this particular case, it enabled us to redefine the levels of hierarchy within bone to 12 orders of hierarchy, which is more than had ever been recorded. But it also gave us insight that enabled us to develop a whole new set of biomaterials that had this sort of nanoscale, different nanoscale organization of organic and inorganic components. And that's something we've been applying a lot in the area of bone repair. So that's in terms of thinking about materials for regenerative medicine. But we also can give additional signals. So for example, we can think about drug delivery in the context of regenerative medicine and other kind of therapeutics. And one of the things we've been very interested in is thinking about physical triggers. And so this is a figure from a review paper that summarizes some of those types of physical triggers. We've worked with all of these, but I would say more so with the kind of mechanical triggers, and in particular thinking about how you can structure materials in mechanically very interesting ways to get them to produce interesting changes in your cells and your tissue. So this is a slightly older example. This is a picture of the first platform we developed that used very, very tiny needles to interface with cells. So these are called nanoneedles. Together with Ennio Taschiotti's group at HMRI, we were the first people to report the use of these. And you can see they're small because this is a single stem cell sat on the surface, and you can get about 50 or more of these per cell. And many, many groups now develop these kind of materials. And so what's interesting is if you look at a cell on the surface, and this is a focused ion beam reconstruction, what you'll see is the nucleus move out of the way and show up in blue here. And we get this kind of close contact between the needles and the nucleus, but they never actually penetrate the nucleus. And so you can use that to your advantage and do things like reprogram cells in vitro, so that's shown on the left there, and then even use them in vivo. So for example, in the first work we published on this, which is back in 2015 there, what we did was to load these with plasmid DNA encoding for vascular endothelial growth factor, put them in contact with muscle in vivo, and then 1 or 2 weeks later, you'll see all these new blood vessels forming, as you can see in the image on the right there. And then over the years, we've made these from many different types of materials, so from porous silicon, but also from different polymers and so on, and use them to deliver all sorts of different cargo, from very small molecules to slightly larger things. And in Daniel Hakim's paper there at the bottom, what we do is we have the needles, actually we have some layer by layer surface structuring so that we can encapsulate interesting cargo that is then used for cell reprogramming on the heart in vivo. And so you can use these kind of things in different ways. And part of it is about delivering molecules, but there's also a very important part of it that's about using these systems as sensors. And so they can interact with cells and tissues and actually measure things that are happening. So some of the things we've done, for example, is to measure pH changes across cells, to measure enzyme gradients across healthy tissue versus cancer tissue, and many, many other things as well. They can also induce interesting mechanobiology and be used to sort of control the way that stem cells differentiate. And then at the bottom, this interesting area where you might use them also for bioelectronic applications. So that's one kind of interface you can use with cells. I'm going to talk a little bit now about different kinds of materials we can use for cells. So in particular, I'm going to focus a little bit on particle-based systems. And this is an image taken from a paper from the literature, not from our group, which in the middle there you can see a zoom-in of a particle. This is a polymer-based particle from a polymer called PLGA, which has actually been on the market for a long time. So this encapsulates this drug called leuprolide acetate, which is used to treat some cancers and also some other conditions. And actually, if you were to look at that middle image, you would think, well, at least I would think, what a beautiful sphere. But then if you zoom out and look on the left, you can see actually the formulation itself is very, very heterogeneous. And so you've got lots and lots of different things going on there and not very good control of the particle morphology. And so we were thinking about whether we could make these kind of sphere-based particles, which of course had been around a really long time, but in a more controllable way. And in particular, we wanted to do that with advanced two-photon printing-based systems. And so to do that, what we had to do was invent a new set of bioinks made from polymers that meant that we could print these materials and they would cross-link. And then we would be able to create these kinds of mini capsules that had exquisite control over the architecture. And so we did that a few years ago with these kind of new bioink systems. And then we thought about, actually, how can we fill these things really precisely with drug? And so we decided to print not only the particles that you can see there in orange, but also the system that would fill them. And so this is what we call a microfluidic loading system. And that, what you can see in blue there, is actually all 3D printed as well. And then we have a special sealing technique. And this leads to the sort of cutest videos in the world, where you can see these little spheres. The next one's even cuter to my eyes. These little spheres filling up with very, very precise amounts of cargo, and then you can then seal them. And so you can fill all sorts of things in these. Some of the work we've been doing has been with the Gates Foundation, where we've made particles that can release cargo at different time frames, so a sort of pulsatile release. The idea here is that we can deliver vaccine to the patient through one injection, and then the formulation itself will deliver its booster dose later in time without you having to vaccinate the patient. And that's really, really important for compliance. And so this very recent paper that's just come out there from David Peeler is all around using these kinds of highly controlled particle systems for in vivo tunable vaccine kinetics. Now, the other thing we've done, as well as modify the actual particle structure to get tunable release, is to think about how we can get release on demand once we've implanted something in the body. So I told a very talented student of mine, Shin, to go and have a little think about nature and biology and get some inspiration about how we would do a sort of bio-inspired approach, really, to controlled pulsatile release. And what he came back with was this video here of this puffball fungus, where it contacts with one drop of water and then releases all of its spores. And he thought, this is really all his idea, he thought, why not have a system where the capsule of these, the top, rather, of these little containers was made from a slightly different polymer. In fact, a polymer that was modified so that it would be responsive to near-infrared light, and it would melt if you shone near-infrared laser at it. And you can do that. You can implant this in vivo, shine the laser through the skin, and then get release of these drugs on demand. And so this is another way of achieving pulsatile release, this time from an external stimulus. Now, we've heard a lot today about different types of materials that can make small drug delivery carrier particles. And so in our group, we work a lot with lipid nanoparticles and polymer-based particles, as well as some biologically released particles. And those are just some of the recent papers that we've done on this. And one of the things we've been interested in is better targeting. So how do you get these things to distribute to the organs you want them to in vivo? And for that, we started doing a lot of work with my colleague, Stefano, around developing new kinds of binders that would be able to bind to many different parts of a protein receptor at once and give a sort of multivalent approach to binding. What we found, actually, is this binding approach ended up being way, way better than using traditional antibodies. And so we were able to protect this pipeline and found this company called Nanograb that now develops these binders. It's doing extremely well. And what we can show through Nanograb's work is much, much better targeting in vivo of particular receptors in different organ systems. But we had another challenge still, which is we work with all these particles, and actually a lot of these we characterize using bulk techniques. And so we do a measurement, and the information we get out is telling us about that whole formulation, but it's not giving us insight at the single particle level. And this is something that I found extremely frustrating. So a few years ago, I said to my group, look, let's come up with a technique where we can measure individual particles, understand their chemistry, and that is surely going to give us much better insight in how we can do better formulation design. And so after a lot of brainstorming and work in the lab, we came up with an approach where we can actually use a laser to trap a single particle and measure its chemistry. And we can do this in an automated way using software that we wrote within the lab. And so this is a technique we've called SPARTA, Single Particle Automated Raman Trapping Analysis. And what we can do is we can trap these nanomedicines using the laser, measure their chemistry with Raman spectroscopy, correlate to that to their size, and even do real-time measurements of reactions. And at the time we published this in NatureCom a few years ago, we had patented this, but it was what was called a breadboard setup. So it was basically you would go into a darkroom, typically be a physicist in my group, and you needed to be pretty expert to use this. And so we've worked really hard since that time to make this more accessible to people and actually have been able to make this into a standalone instrument. And this led to the launching of this company called SPARTA Biodiscovery, where we now have this integrated instrument system where we can analyze particles. They never fly across the room, never seen that, but analyze them with a laser and get out this biochemical fingerprint of what's going on in every single particle, but for many, many particles within a formulation. And so we can start to really understand systems in a way that we previously were unable to. And you can look at very, very complex mixtures, all automated with single particle information. So this is what it looks like. You can apply this to many different systems. This is just some of the papers from our group, but obviously there are other groups now using this and publishing with this. But this is really interesting in terms of thinking about not only your formulation, but how well is drug loaded, are you forming a protein corona, and studying all those kind of things in real time. So very excitingly, we were able to get a big strategic investment from Sartorius, which is a company that probably many of you know, and to take this instrument, which is now CE mark approved and used by many, many pharma companies now, as well as other academics across the world. And so this is a really, really exciting rollout for us. And just in terms of some of the data on this, this is just a study where we look at this for looking at different lipid formulations and also lipid nanoparticle formulations, and also how these respond to phospholipase D, which is an enzyme you have in different enzyme states, disease states in the body, and it can cleave off the head group. And you can follow all this kind of stuff in real time and do this dynamic reaction monitoring, which is really exciting. And then you can also look at exosomes, so these small vesicles released from all types of cells, including cancer cells, do lots of really interesting measurements that tell you about their chemical differences. And then on the left, each one of those dots relates to a different type of exosome released from a different type of breast cancer cell, including cells with different drug mutations, resistances, and so on. And you end up with about a 95% sensitivity and specificity, even if you don't label these, which is pretty cool. And so you can use this now for all sorts of different disease monitoring applications, but also the formulation development and also QC. So last little bit of the talk, I'm just going to reflect a little bit on disease detection that we can do in other kind of systems as well. This is a really short talk, so I'm just going to give a couple examples, but I do want to point out that we have some work I won't talk about today. Dandelion diagnostics is really at the interface of multi-sensor surfaces for longitudinal profile coupled with AI. That's a new spin-out. And then Signature Biosciences looks at multi-gene signatures and actually is now is done really, really well and is now going forward for an FDA concordant study for a 21 gene signature for breast cancer. So a lot of these things are progressing really nicely for us. But, you know, I hardly need to put forward the motivation for early diagnostics and early disease diagnosis. But, you know, this is important for pretty much any disease you can think of, whether it's a cancer, heart disease, antimicrobial resistance, or a viral infection. I mean, the earlier you can detect these things, the better you can treat them. So we use nanoparticle systems made from many different types of nanoparticles, in particular plasmonic ones and catalytic ones, and we think about how we're going to functionalize them. So this biointerface is something very important to us, and we also couple this with a lot of molecular dynamics, which is done by generally by Professor Yarovsky's team, as well as some other collaborators. So this is really a short talk, so I'm going to give you just one example or so of what we do. But just to get across the concept that these systems are very, very versatile. So this is a schematic of a nanoparticle surface, and you can functionalize it in many, many different ways. And so, for example, some of the things we've been doing is functionalizing it so that we can measure different enzymes, like we've done work on proteases, kinases, phospholipases, acetyl transferases. We've done very ultra-sensitive protein detection, nucleic acid detection, and also small molecule detection. And the example I'm going to give you is this one, which is one where we use tiny, tiny gold particles to change the color of your urine so that we can detect an early cancer by detecting the activity of these protease enzymes that can cleave through peptide bonds. So the sensor system shown in the top left there, we have a protein core, and then we can bind to it four biotin groups on the end of four peptide linkers with four tiny gold nanoclusters at the end. That's what the gold nanoclusters look like. And that system, when it's self-assembled, is 11 nanometers in diameter, and it's too big to come out through the kidneys. However, if we have an upregulation of a protease related to the cancer, it can cleave through these peptide chains, release the gold nanoparticles. They're now only 2 nanometers, and that's small enough to get filtrated out through the kidney, end up in the urine. We can add some chemicals to that, and the urine will turn blue. In fact, it turns kind of bluey-green, as you can see here. This is the in vivo work with a mouse model of colorectal cancer, and what we're looking at there is the activity of upregulation of matrix metalloprotease 9. And Sangeeta Bhatia did all the animal work for this study in her lab at MIT. And then more recently, what we've also done is actually massively upregulate the activity, catalytic activity of these systems by changing some of the ligands and so on. And also coupled this again with some of Irene's fantastic molecular dynamic work, and then use this to monitor various bacterial implant infections in vivo, which is kind of useful to be able to know if you're developing a local infection around a new kind of implant site. And so these are very small systems. We've also used larger particles in lateral flow type devices. And in fact, in this work here, which has now gone through early commercial prototyping for manufacture, we were able to develop the first point-of-care test in the world that could detect early HIV without sophisticated instrumentation. This is a few years ago now. In fact, it's the first test in the world that was able to get into this acute stage of detection for early HIV in a lateral flow type format. And a slightly different variant of that technology has now just been developed as the world's most sensitive cholera test. That's just finished field trials in Bangladesh, and will soon go into field trials in Africa as well. And then you can also combine that with CRISPR-based diagnostics, and this led to a test that we have developed. This is also patented, that can distinguish whether patients are having a heart attack or not when they go into the emergency room. So this has been through a small pilot study and is now in extensive conversation with the ambulance service, with the idea that you would take these kind of tests, use them in an ambulance as emergency responders were responding to a patient that may have a heart attack. And so further note about these kind of technologies and how we might think about applying them, you can also couple them to readouts through mobile phones, and this is a big area called mHealth that we summarized in this Nature paper. And that's really important because that really democratizes who can get access to that healthcare. And I just want to show you this video from a center that I'm very proud of called iSense that myself... I was deputy director and Rachel McKendry run this, and this is from some work that was led by UCL, it's one of our partners in the center, where they took these readers out to KwaZulu-Natal, we trained 40 or so healthcare workers out in the field, did many, many thousands of the HIV tests in the field, and then all the data went into these data dashboards, and this enabled then patients to get into faster online care in KwaZulu-Natal, and we've done a lot of work also in Uganda and Ghana as well. And then final slide, because I do want to leave time for Seb to say a few words, because he's the star of the day, is just a shout out to this new centre that we've just had funded. Really grateful for this. This is a £24 million centre. Which is the first centre in the UK to use quantum sensing specifically for healthcare applications. And so we're going to be using really the latest in quantum-based sensing. So these are things like nanodiamonds and nitrogen vacancies in diamonds and so on that can give us very, very ultra-sensitive disease detection. We've got many hospital partners, industry partners, and also this will be coupled to a lot of thinking about the data science side of things and how we bring in concepts around machine learning and so on. So this is a really exciting new project for us. And myself, John Morton and Mete Atatürk will be leading this. And then I'll just finish with the acknowledgements of the wonderful team and the funders and just say, yet again, a really big congratulations to Seb. I know this is a really huge honour for you to do to have this recognition with the Collège de France. So congratulations, Seb. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.